Okay, the title of tonight's session is Among Us, Writing at Emmanuel's Manger. And I'm Sam Grauber, as you know. Do we really want to know God? Her real name is not Louise. The picture making was still going on when your children, George, came along, you, Louise, and you, Junior, and Bert. You had been sent for. There were going to be pictures taken, and you came so late, not only because your house was so far, and because Bert was so slow, whimpering and crying, trying to keep up with you, but also because your mother had taken time to wash you all and to put a clean dress on you, Louise, and a ribbon in your hair. It was the best dress you had, a prettier one than I was to see you wear again. It looked almost, though not quite, like the party dress of a little girl your age in town, of people whose mothers are so nice that they would never speak to yours, unless about putting less starch in the cuffs, please, white and standing out, and so soft and translucent in the sunshine like your own soul. And one could only tell it from a really good party dress by the intense sleaziness and fragility of the cloth through which your body was visible, and the safety pin flower sack you wore as for a clout, and by the rippling, hard, narrow cheapness of the ribbon and meagerness of the sash, which was trying to look like a great blown sunlit bow at the small of your back, and yet to save 5 or 10 cents. And by the stitching, which was done partly by a sewing machine with the gallops and partly by hand. And by a sort of uncertain embarrassedness in which this whole sweet artifact set itself around the animal liveness of your country body. And then too, you yourself gave it away, Louise, for your skin was a special quiet glowing gold color, which can never come upon the skin of nicely made little girls in towns and cities, but only to those who came straight out of the earth and are continually upon it in the shining of the sun, active and sweating, and toughening into work that has already made your clear 10-year-old mouth resolute and unquestioning of personal desire. Your skin shines like a sober lamp in outdoor noon in all this whiteness. Your feet and legs are bare, they were washed, but already they carry the fine orange pollen of the clay. It is entirely obvious that you are not what this dress is pretending you are, Louise, and that the whole thing is a put-up job. But as a matter of fact, I am noticing all this less than your eyes. I am slow, but even so, it would be hard to see them at all and not have lost at least half your soul in them, even before you knew it. And already, though as yet I scarcely realize it, we have begun this looking at each other, of which I am later to become so conscious I am liable to trembling when I am in the same room with you. It is scary, scary as hell, and even more mysterious than frightening. And so tentative as I, who am a painfully tentative person, have never been before. Yet somehow there is nothing shy about it in either of us. It is frequent and through all its guards, wide open. But what is it open upon? Lord only knows. There is no other blankness like you, like these temperatureless, keen, serene, and wise, and pure gray eyes of yours set so wide between your square young temples. And this, as I said, I am beginning only very faintly to realize now, so that I have become quiet in your presence and watchful, yet hardly know this beyond some feeling. Here is a good child. Here is a damned thoroughly good child. James Agee wrote in response to a Partisan Review questionnaire that he had received about his craft of writing, "I conceive of my writing as an effort to be faithful to my perceptions." What happens then when this sort of writer begins to perceive God in his subjects? The answer to that question is this book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. And we'll get to that in just a second. But first I want to point out that this was also something you could have said of the shepherds, keeping watch over their flocks by night. And I'd like to actually pair this reading with the reading that's in front of you, which is Luke's telling of the Christmas story. And I'd like you to listen to this again because it's so familiar. I think this is the one that they use in the Charlie Brown special, which I used to watch when I was a little kid. I'm not positive of that. But it's so familiar because we hear it every Christmas. I'd like you to listen to it again with a new ear, maybe, for the ordinariness of what is happening in this story. And maybe someone else can read those three paragraphs, somebody who's got a voice that can project for the tape. Would somebody read it?
I'll read.
Thanks.
In those days, a decree went out from Emperor Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration and was taken while, help me, Sam, Quirinius?
Quirinius, yeah.
Mm-hmm, was governor of Syria. All went to their own towns to be registered. Joseph also went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David called Bethlehem, because he was descended from the house and family of David. He went to be registered with Mary, to whom he was engaged, and who was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for her to deliver her child, and she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in bands of cloth and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn. In that region, there were shepherds living in the fields, keeping watch over their flock by night. Then an angel of the Lord stood before them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid, for see, I am bringing you good news of great joy for all the people. To you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign for you. You will find a child wrapped in bands of cloth and lying in a manger." And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and on earth peace among those whom he favors." When the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, Let us go now to Bethlehem and see this thing that has taken place, which the Lord has made known to us. So they went with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the child lying in the manger. When they saw this, they made known what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds told them. But Mary treasured all these words and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all they had heard and seen, as it had been told them.
Thanks. So often when we hear this story, I think we focus on the miracle. It's the most sort of dynamic part of it, right? The heavens open, the angels come down, you have the choir singing. It's a little like that narrative from Isaiah where we sort of get a peek into the great beyond. Even though that's a difficult story to tell, I'm wondering if the rest of the story isn't actually trickier to tell. Because at the end of that sort of second section on this sheet that I've given you, the heavens close, the angels go away. And what's left is for these shepherds, who are very ordinary folk, to go to Bethlehem to see the real miracle, which is a baby, an ordinary baby, in a manger. And I know we have all these creche scenes and paintings in the back of our minds where you have these wonderful halos over the Christ child's head. Somehow I doubt it. At least it doesn't seem to be here in Luke. I think he looked like an ordinary kid. Maybe not even with a halo like this hat on this child, the image of Walker Evans. Where do you think you would have to look today to find a manger if this story were going to be played out again? To tell it true, the way it happened, but happening today. What sort of place would you have to look for, do you think? Where would you go?
Maybe to the cabins of migrant workers.
Migrant workers? Yeah. Yeah, we hear these stories sort of a lot, but they also are kind of invisible, a lot of these migrant stories.
Very old Wisconsin cow barn.
A very old Wisconsin cow barn. Okay. That sounds familiar to me because I grew up in rural Wisconsin.
Two teenagers living in public housing, one working in McDonald's.
Oh, okay. Good, yes. Even the job seems right.
Maybe a bus stop or a subway station.
Bus stop or a subway station, yeah. Good. Others?
The cardboard and tin shacks outside of Nairobi or Sao Paulo or...
Yeah, maybe not in America, huh? Maybe Nairobi. Tin shacks. All of these places, of course, are similar because they sort of sound poverty-stricken to us. But there's something else that I think is kind of similar about them, which is that they sort of exist on most of our peripheries. Right? That's part of what seems ordinary about the stories, not just because the Christmas story is about a couple of folks who don't have anywhere else to stay, but also that this is a place that you wouldn't expect to find anything important. And so you wouldn't pay very much attention to that manger on most nights. I think the same is probably true of all of the examples that you just gave us. So part of the question, I think, for us as Christians is to recover at least a little bit of this challenge of finding sacred truths in ordinary realities that otherwise we might just be perfectly contented and conditioned to ignore. There's a little of that also in the story of the disciples. You can read in that very short passage about whether anything good can come out of Nazareth, a little of that, and in a way that's the whole story, isn't it? I mean, take Nazareth and insert your hometown, right? Can anything good come out of Stockholm, Wisconsin? I doubt it, right? There is a sense in which we don't expect to find God in these sorts of places, and especially in the tin shack in Nairobi or any of these other locations. But that's where it happened. And so I think partly because we want to get to truths that are behind the story that we have in the Bible, it maybe makes sense for us to also think about some of the ordinary places in our own experience as places to look for truth, maybe even divine truth. This is partly what James Agee and Walker Evans are up to as they're trying to document the lives of tenant farmers in Alabama. And they give you a couple of descriptions of what they're up to in that preface some of you may have read, which was out today. I think they're funny because they seem sort of to build on one another and also to potentially be contradictory. It starts in a really straightforward way where they just sort of tell you what their project is, right? The nominal subject is North American cotton tenantry as examined in the daily living of three representative white tenant families. That sounds pretty simple, right? That's a job for a journalist or an anthropologist maybe, but not too difficult. The trouble is that Agee and Walker Evans are both artists, and so when they encounter this job that was fit for a journalist, they realize that it's actually much, much more complicated than that. And so they have to add something to it. They say, actually. And that's an important word, actually. Once you see it face to face, the effort is to recognize the stature of a portion of unimagined existence and to contrive techniques proper to its recording, communication, analysis, and defense. And the important word there, I think, is unimagined. There's a sense in which both of these writers, a writer and this artist, are working with a challenge of an audience which doesn't necessarily want to imagine a reality that they're encountering now face to face once they're actually in Alabama. And that's difficult. They have to find a way to communicate this truth, which people are not necessarily willing to acknowledge. How do you do it? Do you take a photograph? Do you write an essay? Do you write a journalistic report? Do you write a poem? Well, in the end, they sort of do all of these things in an effort to communicate this truth. But this is actually not the only level at which they're challenged, because as they're meeting these people, once they get to know them, once they start taking their pictures and writing notes about them, they start to develop a kind of acute spiritual connection to them. They start to see God happening in the story that they're trying to tell. And so in the end, in the middle of a preface, which I think is very unusual, they have this last statement of what they're up to. More essentially, this is an independent inquiry into certain normal predicaments of human divinity. It's quite a statement to find in a preface of a book that in some senses looks pretty ordinary. If you page through this book, a lot of it is just descriptions of the houses. It's talking about what their porches look like, what it's like to sleep on one of their porches, descriptions of these characters, physical and otherwise. And yet what they're up to is trying to communicate certain normal predicaments of human divinity. Now let's hold off on that for just a second, because it sounds almost heretical, right? We're kind of at the edge of dubious theology here. So let's take a break and take a step back from that. Because actually the first problem with this Emmanuel problem of God with us is not the God part. It's the with us part. It's the among us. The problem is not so much getting people to believe in a God who comes to us, which is sort of what we hear in the scriptures, but actually what it means to be among us. What the here and now actually looks like in a place that most of us who have locks on our doors and cable television probably are pretending doesn't exist. I'm going to say that one more time. I think that we actually believe most of the time that the real world does not exist. Once more. We do not believe that the real world exists. But God knows it. And that may be where we have to go to find it. How do we imagine for ourselves the real world that exists? Okay, now maybe some of you don't believe me that we actually do believe that the real world exists. I guess to get at this point, we could do something that A.G. actually does at one point in his more sort of exalted prose, where he's lying on a porch and he's thinking about anything. And he starts thinking about ants. And he imagines an ant colony. So close your eyes and imagine an ant colony. See all that activity? Imagine 100 ant colonies. Imagine 100 times 100 ant colonies. And pretty soon, if you have good imaginations, you realize that the solid ground that you think you've been walking on every day is actually teeming with life. Imagine a sparrow falling from a nest outside your door. Now imagine a billion sparrows falling and flying. Imagine the hairs on your head. Imagine the hairs on your neighbor's head. Imagine the hairs on the heads of 5 billion neighbors. Now imagine a soul that's suffering and give it a name, because you know at least one. And now imagine a suffering soul in all those dark rooms all through the world. It's sort of impossible. Thanks for trying. This is part of the problem that these artists are working against. And they have to start somewhere. So they're going to start with one group of people, and ultimately with one man, this guy, George Gudger, whose name is not George Gudger. George Gudger, A.G. says, is a human being, a man, not like any other human being so much as he is like himself. Think about that for just a second. Not like any other human being so much as he is like himself. It's very easy to imagine 5 billion people in the abstract. It's just a number. Imagining 5 million individuals who are every bit as unique as yourself, that's the trick. A much more important and dignified and true fact about him than I could conceivably invent, though I were an illimitably better artist than I am, is that fact that he is exactly, down to the last inch and instant, who, what, where, when, and why he is. He is, in those terms, living right now in flesh and blood and breathing in an actual part of a world in which also you and I are living. Again, on the surface of it, this sounds very straightforward and obvious. On the other hand, once you think about whether or not you're actually conscious of this fact, you're not. No one in the world knew who George Gudger was, except for a very limited sphere of folks. And yet there's the possibility that if you're a Christian, or even maybe just if you're a human being, you have to acknowledge it. He actually exists. How in the world do you do it? How do you do it? If you're AG, how do you convince someone that other people are actually there, that otherwise wouldn't exist in your imagination? If you're Walker Evans, do you settle for the picture? Does this image do the trick? Are those eyes going to stay with you? Well, interesting enough, one of the ways, and this is a trick, and this is one of the things that's interesting about AG when he talks about writing, he talks about it as a kind of trick. He recognizes that words can't bear that unbearable weight that we've been talking about this week. It can't bear the weight of being, human or God. Language just isn't powerful enough. So you have to take the bargain and play. One of the ways he plays is a technique that actually we've talked about a little bit already. He writes himself into the picture. We talked about this in terms of antimonia yesterday, this idea of my antimonia. That's the story that you can tell, and that in a sense that's a more real story than trying to be objective about it. A.G. says, the most exciting thing to me about George Gudger is that he is actual. He is living at this instant. He is not some artist or journalist or propagandist's invention. He is a human being. And to what degree I am able, it is my business to reproduce him as the human being he is. Not just to amalgamate him into some invented literary imitation of a human being. You can see how this works. As soon as you start talking about him as a sharecropper or tenant farmer, he becomes a stereotype. We know what to think about these people, right? How do you get at the man behind the stereotype? Well, one of the ways to do it is to keep AG in the picture. For that reason and for others, I would do just as badly to simply eliminate myself from this picture as to simplify or invent character, places, or atmospheres. My George Gudger is what you're going to get if you read this book. You're going to get AG in the picture as a way of trying to convey his real conviction that this is a human soul that deserves attention. Those of you who are potentially writers, and again, I'm thinking about this as a possibility for maybe Saturday's session, is to look at some of our own writing, or writing that's been personally important to us. This seems like a worthwhile technique to recall, keeping yourself in the picture. And one of the other ways that I thought we could maybe get at this is by looking at the handout that I gave you, which actually involves both pictures and writing. And some of you may have already read this before we started, so I'll ask you to maybe hold your fire a little bit. For those of you who are slackers and didn't get around to actually reading the text and just looked at the pictures, I was counting on you. What do you see when you look at these images?
Poverty.
Poverty, okay.
Dirty.
Dirt. All right.
No birth control.
All right, it's a large family, that's for sure.
Pain.
Pain.
Despair.
Despair.
Fatigue.
Fatigue.
Lack of education.
A lack of education, how would you know? It's assumed, is it? Probably they don't have letters after their names, PhDs, what have you. What else?
Hardworking.
Hardworking. How do you know?
Just look like they're working hard. Scared?
Scared? Yeah. I think so. I
see,
think
my
that.
Mother's family. I'm from Alabama, very near here, and she grew up exactly in these conditions.
In this condition?
At this time.
Okay. We've got a spy.
A family.
A family. Took a long time to get there.
See,
you're right, though.
The beauty of youth.
The beauty of youth. I hadn't noticed that.
Reality.
Where's the happy face? It's the oldest one. Yeah. Reality, somebody said. Reality. Now this is the question. Is the picture real? A lot of times we think a photograph is reality, and that actually is one of the things A.G. loves about Evan's photographs. He says, they do something that I can never do in words. There's an authority there that I can never achieve. But he thinks words can do something that photographs might not be able to do. And so what I'd like you to do, and perhaps they'll be able to edit out a moment of silence on the tape, is read the text now and see if there is a change in how you see your own vision of the scene because of what A.G. is able to write.
Didn't you want it read out loud?
Maybe we should read it out loud. I was just thinking the same thing, Jack. Would you read the first paragraph there, or the first page?
And it was here that we first saw most of you, scarcely knowing you by families apart. I can remember it so clearly, as if it were 5 minutes ago. And we were just drawn away from your company and were riding the light ridges of the winding road in the silence before we were able to speak a word of you, when the whole time was like one chord and shock of music. How you, Parley, came up a path barefooted, carrying two heavy buckets, a corn chuck hat on the back of your head. You were wearing a dress that had been torn apart a dozen times and sewn together again with whatever thread was handy. So far gone, so all the way broken down into a work dress. There had been no sense to wash it in a year. It had a big ruffle of wrecked curtain lace down the breast. And as you came toward us, you looked at us shyly, yet very directly, and smiling through your friendly and beautiful orange freckled black eyes. And I shall not forget you soon, your courtesy, your dreadful and unanswerable need, your manure-stained feet and legs as you stood in the path and smiled at us. Nor God knows you, Margaret, a year and a whole world more hopeless. Nor you children. You started out from behind the bushes and hid behind one another and flirted at us and ridiculed us like young wild animals. And even then we knew you were wonderful. And yet it is amazing to me now how relatively lightly we realized you then. I think it was that there was so much going on, so richly and so disturbing. Such a strangeness of meaning and precariousness of balance, which I was wishing so much as never before to make secure, chiefly in one, in you, Mrs. Ricketts.
You realize what the poor foolishness of your husband had let you all in for. Shouting to you all to come out, children sent skinning barefooted and slaver-mouthed down the road and the path to corral the others, the woods and the gudgers, all to stand there on the porch as you were in the average sorrow of your working dirt, and get your pictures made. And to you, it was as if you and your children and your husband and these others were stood there naked in front of the cold absorption of the camera, in all your shame and pitiableness to be pried into and laughed at, and your eyes were wild with fury and shame and fear, and the tendons of your little neck were tight the whole time, and one hand continually twitched and tore in the rotted folds of your skirt like the hand of a little girl who must recite before adults. And there was not a thing you could do, nothing, not a word of remonstrance you could make, my dear, my love, my little crazy terrified child, for your husband was running this show, and a wife does as she is told and keeps quiet about it. And so there you stood, in a one-piece dress made of sheeting. It spread straight from the hole where the head stood through to the knee without belting, so that you knew through these alien town-dressed eyes that you stood as if out of a tent, too short to cover your nakedness, and the others coming up, Ivy blandly, whom nothing could ever embarrass, carrying her baby, her four-year-old child, in a dress made of pillow sack that came an inch below his navel. He was carrying a doll, Pearl, with her elegant skin, her red-brown sexy eyes, Miss Molly, and Walker setting up the terrible structure of the tripod, crested by the black square heavy head, dangerous as that of a hunchback, of the camera, stooping beneath cloak and cloud of wicked cloth and twisting buttons, a witchcraft preparing, colder than keenest ice, and incalculably cruel. And at least you could do, and you did it. You washed the faces of your children swiftly and violently with rainwater, so that their faces were suddenly luminous, stuck out of the holes of their clothes, the tightly dampened hair swept clear of the clear and clean of the clear and blessed foreheads of these flowers, and your two daughters standing there in the crowded porch, yielding and leaning their heads profound against the pulling and entanglements, each let down their long black hair in haste and combed and rearrayed it. But Walker made a picture of this. You didn't know. You thought he was still testing around. There you all are, the mother, as before a firing squad, the children standing like columns of an exquisite temple, their eyes straying, and behind both girls, bent deep in the dark shadow somehow, as if listening, and as in a dance, attending like harps the black flags of their hair. And we, the men, meanwhile, Woods and George and I, Fred was in the lineup, talking over and over about being in the funny papers, and about breaking the camera with his face, and laughing and laughing and laughing. We were sitting at the roots of a tree, talking slowly and eating one small peach after another and watching. Well, I was spreading so much quiet and casualness as I could. But all this while it was you I was particularly watching, Mrs. Ricketts. You can have no idea with what care for you, what need to let you know. Oh, not to fear us, not to fear, not to hate us, that we are your friends, that however it must seem, it is all right. It is truly and all the way all right. So continually I was watching for your eyes, and whenever they turned upon me, trying through my own and through a friendly and tender smiling, which sickens me to discuss to think of, to store into your eyes some knowledge of this, some warmth, some reassurance that might at least a little relax you, that might conceivably bring you to warmth, to any ease or hope of smiling, but your eyes upon me, time after time, held nothing but the same terror, the same feeling at very most of, if you are our friend, lift this weight and piercing from us, from my children. For it was of them and of your husband that you had this care at all times. I don't believe one could ever persuade you such a thing can exist as a thought for yourself. And at length, and just once, a change, a softening of expression. Your eyes softened, lost all their immediate dread, but without smiling, and in a heartbroken and infinite, yet timid reproachfulness, as when, say, you might have petted a little animal in a trap, beyond its thorn-toothed fierceness, beyond its fear to quiet, in which it knows of your blandishments, you could spring free the jaws of this iron from my wrist. What is this hand? What are these kind eyes? What is this gentling hand on the fur of my forehead, so that I let my face loose of any control? And it showed you just what and all I felt for you and of myself. It must have been an ugly and puzzling grimace. God knows, no use or comfort to you. And you looked a moment and withdrew your eyes and gazed patiently into the ground in nothing but sorrow, your little hand now loosened in your dress. So it takes a while longer with the language. This is one of the problems of language. In order to tell the truth, you don't just get to snap a picture. You have to pile words on top of words on top of words to tell the story. But what did you hear that might change what you see in that? Yeah?
Well, they're not used to being photographs, so they're definitely like a little timid, and like you said, they felt naked. I thought of like, if you've seen pictures of Native Americans, sometimes they'll look, they won't smile or anything for their pictures, just because, I mean, sometimes they don't know if it's, like, what do you do in a picture, like, do you smile? People who haven't been used to that, like, when I was in Africa, there were some people who wouldn't smile at all, they were just kind of, like some of my host families, but then some of the other ones who had taken family, had other people, like, stay with them and gotten used to getting their pictures taken, they loved playing along with it, but they were used to it, and so these people definitely not used to the camera at all, and just kind of feel like, what is this happening to us, kind of thing. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a bit of a paradox, because of course, because they haven't been photographed before, this is one of the reasons that they're the subject of the study. It's what we don't know. And yet this is also creating a lot of discomfort.
On both sides.
How do you mean?
Well, I think it's, I mean, the awkwardness is felt by the family just as much as it is by AG, and perhaps the photographer, although he's not commenting. But, you know, just the encounter altogether is one that doesn't really have, you know, that every participant is coming to with some degree of trepidation and maybe even embarrassment. Embarrassment on their part due to their poverty, and embarrassment on AG's part due to his sort of the inherent voyeurism in the entire process.
But I think the timidness is in their bodies, it's not in their eyes. Their eyes are all direct. Almost always, even I think in most Native American pictures too, they're usually right out there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's that soul.
Do you know how they were approached to have their pictures taken?
Yeah, that's actually part of the story if you read the whole book. The men are approached.
The men.
And then that's the invitation, is Fred, who's laughing and laughing, is the husband who invites these photographers to come and have a picture of the family, because this is what they told them that they needed to do. And it's the mother, Mrs. Ricketts, who realizes what's actually happening and can't say a word. Can't say anything about it. Yeah.
I'm going to muddy the waters.
Please.
Because it's my nature. Could it be also that she is righteously pissed off that they're there?
Yeah.
He talks about her as being perhaps ashamed and terror-filled at this, and I'm sure that she's knowledgeable enough about the world to know that they're poor and this is embarrassing to her. But I also feel that in that gaze of a very exhausted-looking woman, there might also be fury that her husband has gotten her into this situation, and that James Aggie is using her as a way to either expand upon or try to ennoble poverty in a way that she doesn't believe, as a woman who lives it, should be done.
I love it. Thank you. Yes, and it says your eyes were wild with fury. That's the first word. And shame and fear.
Mm-hmm.
But fury first.
But I think she's just pissed. I would be.
Okay.
I would be at my husband, first of all, but also at Aggie. But also at Aggie, or Aggie, however you say it, for thinking that my life is something that he can manipulate in his own fashion for his own agenda.
Uh-huh.
As an author, he obviously has one.
Yeah.
Sam?
Yeah.
Yeah. At this point, I don't know if she knows what Aggie is thinking.
No, I have no idea. I've not read it.
But I'd like to add a little muddying.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to add the possibility of an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because when I look at this picture, if you look at the posture of these people, they're straight, and they're looking directly, and I see a great deal of dignity. And there is very little dignity described in this passage, except for the little girl in the beginning. And so I would open up the possibility that he's making all this stuff up because that's what he wants to think.
Yeah, except the reason I think he's talking about it is because he shares that sense of that they have dignity. I think that there's a judgment that's being, a camera has exposure. I love to take pictures, I hate to have them taken up. It exposes, and this is an exposure, and there is an exposure to judgment, whatever, on any side of this, as far as I can tell. And that there's some sense that he, what is that, what is this, is it Abraham? Noah, who gets exposed and his sons, you know. I mean, there's something like that going on, for whatever purpose. There's some form of exposure, and the common weakness is, I think, part of what he's trying to write. We share the weakness. We look different. We aren't different. I might be reading my own thing into that, but I think that's a possibility. He's trying to clothe them in some sense.
But I'm saying maybe it seems to me like he's reading thoughts into their minds.
Sure.
That may or may not be there.
Right.
I'm going to add to that. Isn't every witness unreliable, every narrator unreliable? Because you asked earlier, is what's real? Mm-hmm. Real is through the lens of our own experience. And because our experiences are so different and our backgrounds are so different, we're going to read into this through us. So I don't think there is a one reality.
Maybe if it's relative.
Go ahead, sorry.
I sense an objectifying of this family because I think of family photos. My mother was raised in poverty, uh-huh. as many of our parents were uh-huh. during the Depression, and the only photo of their family was taken so it could be viewed by people who love them.
Yeah.
For generations to come. And here we are, I have no idea who these people are, and we're looking at their family picture.
Yeah.
There's something that feels wrong to me about that.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have money to go have a family picture taken.
Yeah.
Kind of on top of that, I see a lot of mistrust in their eyes, and especially in the boy to the far left, his posture, and the girl to the far right. They're kind of standing sideways, not revealing themselves fully.
Yeah. Yeah, almost want they almost want to slip out of the frame. Yeah.
I can't get over the sturdiness of these children.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they look to me like they're standing still for a minute, but they can't wait to get back out and get into mischief. You know, there's something so compelling about them.
Isn't it interesting that A.G. tells us that the kids are ridiculing them? Flirting and ridiculing, he says, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of this is a question, again, if it's true that we can't get at reality. You can think about this in sort of relative terms. Is it better or worse to have A.G.'s account, whether or not you trust him or not? Is the picture enough? Or is the picture by itself a huge problem?
A movie would be best.
A movie. He talks about that, actually. A.G. loves movies. He thinks moving pictures are just great.
Right, he refers to these as a non-moving picture.
Non-moving picture is part of the problem.
Does he say why the father's not in this picture?
No, other than just he's sitting around eating peaches. There are pictures of the father, and he also takes family portraits of other families with the father in them. But, yeah, I'm not sure.
That's just the oldest.
It seems to me this picture, compared to the one you've got up on the screen, it's like the photographer, he's showing much more of them, and now we've just got the headshot of the father looking much different than his family.
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually, this is a different guy.
Oh, that's not the father.
No, sorry, yeah, this is George Gudger, so it's one of the other families that they stayed with. He's the father of the girl who is the first image that you saw. I don't have a picture here of Ricketts. I didn't bring him along. Yeah?
I always think whenever I look at pictures where people are lined up for a picture, that it kind of stresses me out. I think if the photograph would have been of them even hiding in the bushes, it would have been more them, you know, more, they would have had more control over their incarnation or their revelation of themselves, you know,
Yeah.
What were the dates of these pictures?
1936. Again, this is a basic problem, right? You can see this is a political problem, you can see it as an artistic problem, it's a problem of representation, it's a problem of writing, it's a problem of photography, it's a problem of reality. There's all sorts of different ways to view it. But I think one of the ways to look at this is also as a particularly Christian problem. And one of the possibilities, and again, this is another one of those sort of dubious uses of scripture, which I will admit to readily. I want to think about it a little bit, partly because I think when we look at pictures like this, sometimes we have this knee-jerk response where we say, okay, there's an appropriate political response, we're being asked to be particularly liberal or conservative or what have you. There's an answer to this that we sort of know that has to do with how we treat other people. We should be good to other people. And one of the things I want to think a little bit about is that this is also about the viewer. It's not just about the people on the other side of the picture. Image. Whoops. Now I'm going to have a hard time because I don't know how to go back. Oh, yes, I do. And I think about this in terms of one of the most problematic passages to me in Scripture, which is chapter 25 of Matthew, which is where we get this message about the least of these. And I want to pair it with one of the things Susan was talking about this morning, about these meanings of us, these three wases. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and with God, and the Word was God. Do I have that right? Mm-hmm. More or less. And I got rid of the article.
Perfect.
As you suggested. I've got three wases. I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to the least of these, you did not do it to me. That's Matthew. And now I'm wondering about this as a possibility. And this is partly because of what Susan was talking about this wonderful notion that in the beginning is actually not about the beginning of time, but actually about being beyond time, about a kind of eternal now. And this is a possibility. In the now, you are. You exist. And you are with the least of these. We are all living on the same planet. You are with them. And you are the least of these. What I'm suggesting in that sort of reworking of Scripture, putting together two passages that don't necessarily have much to do with each other, is the possibility, and I just leave this open to your own internal debates, that in order for you to be who you are, not just in the psyche sense, but in the zoe sense, you need to find a way to recognize that you are with the least of these. That you are the least of these. Something about looking behind this picture, or these words of a certainly untrustworthy narrator, because they're all untrustworthy, somebody mentioned. Looking behind them for the truth that other people in the world actually exist is how you're going to become who you are. Doesn't have to do with a moral obligation necessarily. It has to do with existence. Are you really there? Are they really there? That's just a suggestion. I thought we might close. Can somebody tell me how much time we have before chapel?
20 minutes? 7:10.
Maybe we could look at a couple of images. And one of the things that I suggest is the benefit of what we read from A.G., whether or not you trust him or not, is that at least someone else is there. It's not just the camera. And this is how he talks about Evans in this instance. Even though Evans is a great artist and exerts a lot of control over the camera, he talks about it as a kind of terrible and cruel apparatus. Whether your children's faces are washed or not, you're going to get your picture taken. You don't get to choose. You are going to stand in front of that firing squad, and we're going to shoot. Okay? The fact that you have someone else there, a shadow of the photographer, as it were, who's present and in sympathy, at least to the degree that he's able, with the people that he's photographing, seems to me to be important. And maybe this is also something that we can do for ourselves, to look at these images, and whether or not we have AG with us, to find a way to look behind into what's actually going on. And I actually think in some of your knee-jerk responses, this was already happening. You were not just giving the stereotypical reading necessarily of these images. You were starting to see the existence that was behind the image. And that's one of the things that I'm wondering whether people would be able to help each other with, is we're looking at a couple of other images from Evan's collection, which is in this series. And if you think of them and want to hold on to them in the silence of your hearts, that's okay. But if anybody wants to shout anything out, have a response to try to get at maybe what's behind the image for the rest of us, I would definitely encourage it. And I'm just going to go ahead and show you a couple of these without words, just the images, and see if we can't do a little of what AG was trying to do. This is one, and I apologize for the black circle.
Friend.
Those little feet would grow into those big feet.
Sorry, could you speak up?
How those little feet will grow into those big feet.
Yeah.
Walk the same path.
Still have the holes in the clothes.
The holes in the clothes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's made a toy out of something.
What I get out of it is the kid doesn't have a choice right now where he's at, but the father's there with him. I assume it's his father.
Yes.
And the father has had a choice in where they are today because of the father.
What a horrible situation to be in.
Mm-hmm. I see the dry sand or dirt underfoot.
Yeah.
First word I thought of was innocence.
Huh. Yeah.
Safe. He looks like he's maybe a little perplexed on what's going on, but he doesn't seem moved out by it because that big person next to him is a safety.
And he's almost tucked behind his knee.
Yeah.
Hey, he's got a dad. That's pretty important.
Yeah.
I see all the footprints and the lines in the sand.
Yeah. I see inevitability.
I see shelter in two ways, the human and then the building behind.
Yeah.
The boy who has a place to sleep and someone to be.
Yes. He talks about the houses a lot, not always and without fondness.
The child is poor, but probably not malnourished.
Okay.
like the average American farm family in the 1930s.
Okay.
Here. I see a determination in his face, and he seems lots older than in that particular expression, as if he was mirroring determination to get through what he's seen his folks. Hmm.
I wonder why his tongue is sticking out. He's mimicking his dad, sticking his tongue out at someone else.
These aren't right or wrong answers, right? Part of what we're doing is something for ourselves. This little boy is 80? 70? Nobody really knows what's in his head. He doesn't even probably know anymore what was in his head. But it's important to look, and to look behind. One that's called Sharecropper's Grave. It's not cropped right, but.
Is it really a grave?
Empty plate?
That's, I think, what its title is in the archive, yeah.
Well, if you see how barren the dirt is around it, you know that those sharecroppers are working awful hard for not much for sure.
Yeah.
I think of the verse where it says, did you not know that your bodies are a temple of the Lord?
To me, it looks like the dead person is vulnerable to wild animals. They don't have the protection of being buried deep enough, and they didn't have the protection of enough things in life to keep them from a lot of danger.
As opposed to the gated cemetery, I suppose.
Or just being deep enough. Mm-hmm.
The shattered earth over his grave and the very composed earth all around it and the shattering of whatever life he had with his family or his family losing him.
Do you think when they take that picture that they're trying to evoke some sort of a personal sorrow, personal loss that each individual has had, and they're trying to evoke that emotion from that picture, because each one of us in this room has had some sort of a loss, some sort of pain, and when you look at that picture, all of a sudden it just evokes those feelings.
Yeah. I think it's interesting how the photographer has, like, okay, at this point the person has one remaining piece of identity, and it's on that tombstone. And the photographer has chosen not to show us that. Yeah.
The thing that looks like the plate makes me think Isaiah 25 and the heavenly banquet with the, you know, well-aged meats and, or fresh meats and well-aged wines or whatever, that this guy's at a banquet now, so whatever the bleakness of this picture, that plate is saying there's more to the story.
Maybe that's a good metaphor for these photographs. More to the story.
I too was struck by how shallow the grave appeared, but I went to the next question of why was he or she buried so shallowly? What was it that the people digging the grave didn't have the energy to dig any deeper?
Mm-hmm.
Or was it because the grave diggers felt this person wasn't worth the effort? Or so the shallowness, you know, opens up a whole series of questions about the worth of the person.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's changing though with, you know, a sign of wealth used to be that you'd buy a metal casket and a concrete vault and it'd be buried deep. Now, the majority of the people that whose funerals I preside at choose to be cremated. So you go to dust a lot quicker that way.
Yeah.
From dust you came into dust you shall return.
From a Hinduism concept, the body is just a vessel. The soul is eternal. The soul never dies. So therefore, the body is kind of from this life to the next, it's just a, something to provide host to, but it doesn't hold any meaning, or so therefore in that sense that's why they never bury, because the body is useless. The soul is what's the importance, and thus and the focus is on the soul. Therefore they do cremation, and therefore they're trying to be one with the earth and one with nature.
And this one, I see fetal alcohol syndrome. The close eyes, the kind of offset, the deep drop, it stands out. I don't know if I'm right, but it just screams out at me. It's typical of AFK as well.
That straight part in her hair.
Yeah.
I think this is a close-up of the farmer's wife in American Gothic.
Maybe, yeah, when she was a little younger. Yeah. This is Annie Mae Gudger, which is not a real name. If you read the book, you'll find out she's terrified of thunderstorms. It's odd how knowing something about that changes how you look at her picture.
I see defiance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She looks so young, but she doesn't have any teeth. Or maybe she's got some, but out the front ones.
There's so many straight things. The part and the eyebrows and the mouth. So many straight lines.
But look at her neck. I mean, low in her neck, there's all those curves that don't belong there.
She almost seems to have no shoulders. I mean, the shoulders.
Well-worn mule, just,
yeah, right.
Just not fed enough and worked too hard.
She's also, so go ahead.
I'm sort of coming from a different place. I see the defiance, I see some anger in terms of why she's where she is, but I also see, and maybe it's because I want to, but I also see that she's saying to us, I will get through this, and I have pride, and and I'm going to be okay, and things will get better.
Huh. Yeah.
Now I also see strength. Mm-hmm.
Her garment is patterned, mm-hmm. whereas the garment on the other mother that we saw, you know, looked like a plain sackcloth, and the patterning here seems somehow almost more refined.
I see unpainted boards behind an unpainted face weathering the storm.
Are these the same boards as we saw behind the baby?
Yeah, it's the same family.
Uh-huh. Interesting, because she's standing and Dad is scooched down on the ground.
Any guesses? I think this one's only title is landowner, actually.
Well, now you do, right? I shouldn't have said that.
His hands and shoulders look tired, too.
Mm-hmm.
He looks tired. He'll feed it.
His hands look a lot more worn than his face does.
But being the landowner, he's certainly dressed a lot differently than the sharecroppers.
Well, since the bell is rung, I'm going to encourage anybody who wants to see all of the images that are used to take a look at the books that are in the bookstore. If you want to borrow my copy, you can as well, but those pictures are all in there. The other thing I'd encourage you to think a little bit about, since we talked a little bit about the more journalistic side of AG, even the description that we read was sort of journalistic, there's a little passage called The Signal. In the handout that was out, there were 20 copies out. It's quite poetic, really strange, and it's really just an account of the sun coming up on a humble base on a shelf in a room that he's sleeping in one of these tenant homes. And it's very interesting what he does with a very simple scene, which sounds to me like religious prose, but you can decide what you think. Thanks.